This is the thing that I think I would like everybody to understand. Most of the concern and the anxiety about psychic work is really held by the middle class. And most of the people that are making the most money in the world, and I say this with absolute confidence because I know them, they are using any form of extra information that they can. They don't care where and how I get the information. They care about the bottom line.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of the people shaping our common life. My guests come from a huge range of political, metaphysical, and professional perspectives. And I'm delighted that my guest today is Dr. Kate Thomas, who is a philosopher and spiritual mentor. Kate, thank you so much for being here.
Such a pleasure. I'm excited.
We are going to go deep fast, which I think you will be okay with. And I am going to ask you, what are your sacred values? What are the things that you want to be defining your life that you're trying to live by?
So I love this question. And it took me a little while to try and reduce down what my sacred values were to two or three, because I think that most of how I try to live my life, or rather, I suppose how I do live my life is governed really by these things. So I take the sacred really seriously. And as a magical practitioner, as a witch, the sacred is something that governs, you know, pretty much all parts of my day. But I suppose the primary, I don't even know how to describe whether these are things or these are beings or these are relationships, but I think that I understand the sacred as being those things that we value above all else and that are somehow connected to the divine. And so for me, the things that I think are most directly related to the divine are desire. I think desire is really sacred. And I hold relationships as really sacred. And I don't mean just, in fact, I rarely mean just romantic relationships. I mean relationships as crucibles for transformation, for change, and relationships that connect us to what I believe is the truth of reality, which is that we are all deeply connected. So for me, desire is very sacred. Relationships, engaging with each other, with other beings, with other spiritual beings, material beings, those are very sacred. And then when it comes to values, I mean, honesty, integrity, and kindness kind of show up for me as being, you know, the guiding principles of my life and my work.
Yes. And can you think of a time where one of those or several of them have been, I guess, challenged? Or I often find that we're not always sure what our sacred values are until we get to a fork in the road and we're tempted to compromise on them, right? Where there's a choice to be made and we can either choose for them or we can choose against them. Have you had, and you know, we don't always choose for them. I definitely don't always choose for mine. Have you had, moments in your life, decisions you've had to make where those values have guided you in some way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, for me, one of the most important kind of ways of engaging with the world and relating are connected deeply to these things that I consider sacred. And I suppose what I have experienced myself and also in terms of the clients that I work with, the people that I work with, is that actually I think those qualities, those you know, the sense of desire being sacred and relationships being sacred are challenged most often when it comes to our relationship to ourself. And of course, you know, our relationship with ourself is I believe, I absolutely fundamentally believe this, is what governs every part of our experience with the world. And so when I think about, you know, moments in my life where that concern about, you know, am I, you know, fork in the road? Am I going to make the quote right decision in alignment with my values? It's always going to come down to my relationship to self. And so I think that desire, for example, when I talk about desire as being sacred, I don't mean, you know, wanting a material thing, although that could be part of it, but more, I think that the relationship to self is mediated by desire. I believe actually that our desires are, and I'm going to use God language here. I mean, my PhD is in Christian theology, so I'm kind of heavily influenced by the Judeo-Christian tradition for good and ill. But, you know, I think that our desires are sacred in that they are divinely given to us in order for us to establish stronger and better relationship with ourselves. And when we follow those desires, those true desires, we're able to show up and manifest the tiny shard of the divine that is ourselves. And I think that's our only job. I think that's our only responsibility on this earth, honestly. Everything comes from that. And so when I have found myself in moments, which is, you know, quite often, I think that's the point of having values, isn't it? Is that they're sort of guidelines to keep us within the track or the road of, I mean, we could talk about destiny, which is distinct from fate, of course, but within the sort of guidelines of our lives, whenever I find myself in a situation where I'm having to really rely and come back to, like, what is sacred to me? How can I make this decision so that it is in alignment with my integrity and authenticity? It will always come down to my relationship to self and ultimately my relationship to my desire. What is it that I want? What is the ultimate experience that I'm trying to achieve here? And that gives me the ability to make a decision that otherwise might have been quite difficult.
That's so interesting. It's making me think about the way the different, you know, the great wisdom parts, the different spiritual traditions think about desire. And I certainly have found that part of my sort of growing up, my soul has been learning to distinguish between the you should call them deep desires, you know, in my language, the desires of my soul, right? Which are for relationship, right? With relationship with God, relationship with others, relationship with the earth, those things that move me into connection. That's my definition of fully aliveness. Yes. And then these more transient passing things, which feel like desire, but actually might be ways that I'm trying to numb or escape or consume, these kind of more cravy passing things that don't actually satisfy. How do you in your life learn to distinguish between those two different types of desire?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that there is the desires that emerge as part of our conditioning as human beings that live in a culture with other humans. And at the moment, we're living through, under, perhaps we could say, a late stage colonial capitalism. And so a lot of the desires that we're encouraged to have are going to be in support of sustaining that structure or those structures of oppression. So, for example, when we desire to have, and I have these desires. This isn't me saying I don't have these desires. I very much have these desires. But, you know, like if I have a desire for a particular pair of shoes, for example, you know, I would recognize that as a desire that is true and authentic to me, but it's also conditioned and cultivated in some way by structures that are trying to contain me and disconnect me oftentimes from the truth of our existence, which is that we're all connected and part of the same. And then I think there are those other desires, as you describe, that I would describe as deeper desires, which are the sacred desires. And I think that sacred desires will always be ultimately in service of unity, community, and connection, and feeling, experiencing that, right? So I think deeper desires versus you know, surface. I mean, when I say surface level, I mean, you know, I'm going to use astrology speak because it's one of the languages that's very important to me. But, you know, I have a sun in Taurus, Scorpio ascendant, which for those people that know anything about astrology will know that the people that have sun in Taurus are very considered to be quite materialistic. They're considered to really love luxury and beauty. Now, my desire for a particular pair of shoes might actually feel quite important and deep to me, even though I can rationalize and say, oh, you know, this is just capitalism working. It's consumerist magic on me to make me want something. But when I investigate that desire, what I can often find is that at the core of that seeming surface level desire for a pair of shoes is actually a desire to be seen in a particular way. And underneath that desire, if I investigate it, is a desire to be connected and to be seen authentically as a part of myself, to be seen so that I can be in relationship and community with others. Though I wouldn't probably, sometimes I wouldn't buy the shoes, but the point is that I've gained clarity about actually what I really want. And that desire, that true deep desire, will always, I believe, for everybody, by the way, I think this is just universally the case, will always lead to community, connection, unity.
Yes. Thank you. We're going to come back to all of that. So much I want to dig into with you. But first, I want to just get a sense of where you've come from. You know, how did Kate Thomas emerge? Could you give us a little word picture of your childhood, maybe the years before you were 10? What were the big ideas in the air that were forming you?
So I had quite a difficult, traumatic even, I would own childhood. And a huge amount of it was connected to being sort of geographically nomadic, obviously under the age of 10 without any choice about it. And so most of the experiences that I had that I can see have shaped me. And I don't feel... that this was necessarily a bad thing, it just is what it is, were connected to deeply desiring anchoring and rooting. But also, I am autistic. I wasn't diagnosed as autistic until I was in my late 30s. But I was, now looking back, I can see my childhood and just think, oh my goodness, like it's so obvious. I would have been immediately flagged and diagnosed if I were a child now. But of course, this was like the 80s, the very early 80s. So that didn't happen. And so a large part of my experience as a child was just complete confusion as to why people weren't being honest. and when I was being honest, as I perceived it, just being telling the truth about things or perceiving things in a particular way and then communicating that with the intention of clearing up misunderstandings or, oh, maybe people just didn't know or understand this thing, would be met with punishment and ostracization. So most of my early childhood experiences and the sort of big ideas that shaped me were really around justice, confusion around truth. But also I was some people would term psychic. I'm not a great fan of the term for a bunch of reasons that I'm very happy to talk about. But I had a particular experience of the world which meant that I had access to an awful lot of extra information that most people didn't. And I was receiving all of this extra information in the form of, I would describe them now as intuitions. I just had knowledge of things that I didn't get logically. I would see particular beings, spiritual beings, I would describe them as now. I saw the links and the connections between ideas visibly, almost materially. And I was so confused why other people didn't. And then even more confused when I was trying to tell them about these connections and explain to them in a genuine way why that got me in a lot of trouble. And I think when I was a child, I was also just a bit obsessive, as a lot of autistic people are, but particularly around environmentalism, animal rights. I just had these very, very deep relationships with animals and the natural world that was just completely like integrated into who I, like I didn't understand this distinction and separation between humans and animals in terms of, eating animals, for example. I think I must have been like 4 or 5 when I realized that, what was being fed to me was an animal, and I was obsessed and loved animals so much. So this was just absolutely world-shatteringly awful for me. And then completely confused by, like, why can't people see that we are all connected, and that if I'm, harming the natural earth, we're harming the natural earth, we're harming ourselves. And it's a sort of naivety, it might be understood as, but I think naivety is very beautiful. But it was a very intense experience of not really understanding why how I experienced the world wasn't the same as other people, and more importantly, why when I was trying to share that, it would be met with persecution. And yes, by the way, not very much has changed. I'm 43 and I'm still absolutely being persecuted, as many others are, for being a witch and and naming these things that everybody knows that, exists. But yes.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much.
I'm sorry that was such a difficult period for you. Am I right in thinking that there wasn't any kind of spiritual or religious kind of familiarity amongst your parents, your wider family?
Right. So my kind of ancestral religious background is Jewish and Catholic, but neither of my parents were religious. In fact, they were both sort of dogmatic atheists, and you know, had quite strong reactions to their own religious upbringing, which meant that obviously religion was just something that was considered manipulative and harmful and oppressive. And of course, it can absolutely be that. But then what was thrown into that bundle was any form of spirituality or anything, you know. Technically, I don't know that they would have this language, but my parents were, I now would understand, as, you know, materialists. So ultimately, anything that wasn't empirically evidenced was considered invalid. And so that was 90% of my experience, was absolutely not empirically evidential. Not yet. I mean, now, because I've refined my skill and I know how to navigate the world, I can call up, you know, evidence for these things. But as a seven-year-old, that was just absolutely not a possibility for me. Yes, the relationship to spirituality and the relationship to religion was very much one of, I would say, taboo almost. You know, like it was denigrated, and people who were religious were very much looked down on. They were considered to be anti-intellectual. They were considered to be, you know, just like weak in some particular way, because why would you need, you know, some sort of cosmology? Again, my parents wouldn't have had this language, I don't think, but it was really quite oppressive. And I think particularly because my experience of being in the world, you know, was, I would not have understood it, and I didn't understand it as spiritual or in any way religious until at least the age of 13, 14. You know, I just was having these experiences, and I didn't know that they were taboo until I would try and express them, and then it would be shut down. Shut down. So I learned, or ridiculed, and the way that it was shut down was ridiculed. So I learned very early on that it wasn't very safe to explore or ask questions or explain or talk about the experiences that I was having. And this followed me all the way through, you know, my life, and it's still obviously, well, maybe not obviously, it's still very much, you know, a kind of factor that I'm aware of when I do my work, which means that in order to do my work, in order to be in the world and be who I am, you know, it's actually like I have to move through trauma responses that have come from quite, I think, not just my childhood. I think this is sort of an ancestral cultural history, but certainly my lived experience as a child was, you know, yeah, if you identify or you have any sort of interest or express any concern with the spiritual, you would just be ridiculed and considered anti-intellectual and not very smart. And being smart was really the only thing that was important in my family.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something which may or not be possible. And I know this because sometimes people ask it of me and it's not always possible. But one of the divides that I think exists, I'm really interested, and I think I need to get out of this binary way of thinking, but one of the differences that exist, and probably people sit on a spectrum, is those of us who have mystical, ecstatic, spiritual experiences, of which that's how I became a Christian. I prayed, God, if you're there, would you show me? And then I had a like out cold on the floor spiritual experience. And I still have intense, ecstatic spiritual experiences. And similarly, lots of people think I'm a complete weirdo and I'm just caring less and less than that as I go. But I'm, you know, lots of my friends are similarly, my husband is a philosopher and he talks about being educated into imbecility. We're also nerds. Lots of my friends have, you know, what I would think was very left hemispheric forms of formation, or just temperamentally, even if they're not hostile to the idea is in the way that you experienced, it is just not something they seem able to access nor understand. Could you just maybe an earliest experience or one of your experiences. What do you actually mean when you say that? What happens?
Yeah, for me, as a child, it would be quite literally that I would have a vision. I would be lying in bed and an angel would arrive at the end of the bed. I didn't know, I wouldn't have been able to understand it. I didn't describe it as an angel then, but a being that was made of light. Literally, I visually saw this. This wasn't in my mind, although, of course, you know, that's a bigger question between what's what. But I saw a being of light appear at the end of my bed when I was very sick. One day, I must have been 4 or 5 years old. I don't remember like what was going on in my life at that time. I just think I was about this age. And a communication between that bright light and me occurred. And that communication was just instantly soothing. I don't know how else to describe it other than everything that I was concerned about or worried about, which as a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, but that was, you know, very connected to everything, was quite an intense experience of anxiety just living, was just gone. And I felt a sense of peace that I can't really adequately, is not, you know, it's one of the definitions or rather William James's definitions of the holy or a religious experience specifically is that it's ineffable, which means it's impossible to communicate adequately. Language is not possible. And when we look at, you know, the testimonies of people, but particularly women who have been labeled as mystics throughout history, and this was my PhD, so it's an obvious area of expertise and interest for me, we see that everybody has this same, what you're describing as well, which is, you know, there is not language that is adequate to communicate the experience. It is totally ineffable. But I can do as good as I can. So these sorts of experiences would be like that. Like I would see something and have a knowing that that experience or that being was good, like without you know, being able to be more accurate than that, just goodness. I would now describe it as holy or even maybe sacred, and that the purpose of that communication was to soothe me, and it worked. Another example would be, you know, that would get me in trouble. That wouldn't get me in trouble. That would just get me ridiculed or told that I was having a fever dream because I had a temperature or whatever. But, you know, I knew for me it was meaningful. Another experience would be if my mother was having an argument or a disagreement or falling out with one of her friends, I would know all of the details about that without her having said anything about it. I knew the intricate details of the falling out, and more importantly, that what she had done that she wasn't able to acknowledge or see. And I would, at 8 years old, walk down the stairs and have this download, this information. Not really a big fan of the download analogy, but it's as good as we can get with this sort of thing. That I just knew everything. I saw everything. And then I would say, oh, but don't you think it's, you know, the reason she's not talking to you is because you did this thing. And, you know, that, I mean, obviously I would not do that now because of questions of consent. And also just, I don't want to get involved in anybody's business that's not paying me a lot of money to get involved in their business. But, you know, that sort of thing. So a whole variety of different experiences. You know, it wasn't just sort of one medium, I suppose. It was, I would have ecstatic experiences, one-off kind of spiritual experiences where a being would show themselves to me and communicate something. Another time I saw the earth move as if it were breathing, and it was shown to me that it was breathing because it was alive and this was a being. So literally I would be in a field on a school trip, and we were, you know, casting these, I mean, it's funny, casting circles now, which means a very different thing, but there were these sort of circular rings that we would be taken into this field at school. It was a school field trip. It wasn't a common thing. This was unusual, but it was like a big, you know, day out, and you had these plastic rings, and you'd throw the rings down on a patch of grass, and then you'd crowd around the ring and then count what insects and plants and flowers would be in that ring. And while we were doing this, I quite literally had one of these experiences where the earth started to breathe. And then I saw that all of the animals and all of the plants and all of the, you know, everything that was there was living within and on, just as we are living within and on this being that is very much alive and was able to communicate with me. And I was able to understand and communicate with with them. And then I would be like, did you see this? Did you see it? And of course nobody saw it because, you know, it was an experience that I had, you know, but it's very difficult to sort of, communicate the power of that. You know, it's like it gives you information, or it gives you an experience. Information is not the right word. It gives you an experience that enriches and strengthens your understanding of your relationship to everything. So coming back to the sort of first thing that we were talking about, the sense of desires and relationships being sacred. You know, I believe relationship is everything. You know, how we relate to ourselves is the primary relationship, and it's through that relationship that we're capable and able to relate to other beings. And most of my experiences, spiritual experiences, and you know, later on they became religious experiences, were connected to, you know, having a now I guess I would probably describe it as a privileged relationship to the world and other beings.
Thank you. You ended up having to leave home at 15. I can imagine that was pretty difficult.
Yeah. I went from the frying pan into the fire, although at the time I felt like I had no option, no choice. So I did leave home at 15. And I immediately entered a relationship with a man who was 20 years older than me. So now, of course, I look back and after sort of 20 years of therapy, can see, oh, this was actually a really abusive relationship that had at the center of it grooming. And yet at the time, for myself, I felt and understood myself to be completely in control and in charge. This was a decision and a choice that I made. It was a calculated decision. I needed to get out of the house that I was in, the environment that I was in, and, you know, improve my circumstances. And actually it did. So I don't even think, you know, this is, I'm very fascinated by, you know, multiplicity of perspectives. I don't think that there is a single view on anything. That doesn't mean that there's not truth, but I think that, you know, truth is multifaceted, and depending on one's capacity to hold multiple perspectives at the same time, we have a greater access to truth. I can now look back and say it was both true that was a very abusive relationship where I was groomed by a paedophile, and at the same time, I was absolutely aware of a facet of this where I was choosing to, you know, get out of the situation I was in and improve my situation incrementally. So it's you know, I think with all things, we can't really, there's no point in trying to, I mean, obviously we can't change what has happened, but we do have the capacity to make meaning. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I work an awful lot on for myself, but also with the people that I work with and all of the work that I do and the teaching that I do, is focused on actively making meaning. What do we want the meaning to be? I don't think meaning is given. I think that that's part of what it is to be human, is that we make meaning. And I think it's very, very important that we intentionally and consciously make meaning. Mm. And so for me, that period of my life, from, you know, I met him when I was 14 and he was 34, I think. You know, that has been an integral part of what has shaped my perspective and my experience. But it was also something that I've managed to make very, very meaningful in a very positive way. I mean, I don't feel it's no longer just a source of trauma and suffering for me.
Mm. And during that time, we can drill into this word psychic, but I've certainly heard you describe yourself as working as a psychic. Could you say a bit what that means?
So I started when I was 17, taking money for access to this extra information that I received. So like the example of coming down the stairs and my mum being like upset that she's broken this friendship, and being able to see precisely what it was and where she's not taking responsibility and what needs to be done to remedy it. I have that ability and have refined that ability because I believe that intuition is a faculty, the faculty of I was going to say of the mind, but again, the philosopher in me is like, I don't know if we can separate the mind. You know, I'm not really a Cartesian. So I don't believe in this sort of duality, let's say, between sort of body and mind. Yes, I think that working as a psychic now, I would say, means having a very refined intuitive faculty that, for me, means that I can access information that most other people cannot, and most of the time, that information is going to be in service of liberation. And so that might be liberation for the person in that particular circumstance or situation that they're in, or it might be liberation collectively. I think in the best examples, it's both. Now, in intuition, when I say intuition is a faculty, I think that everybody has the capacity to be intuitive. I think intuition is something that is, again, I'm problematizing every word. I can't really help it. A natural. I think it's something that is intrinsic, let's say, to being a being, to being not just a human. Like, I think my cats are very intuitive. I think plants are very intuitive. Anything that is a being. And again, I'm an animist, so that means that I think everything's a being, including the speaker, microphone, and computer. But we can talk about that maybe another time. But I think that intuition is integral to what it is to be. And I think that it's possible to cultivate, just as it's possible to cultivate a talent or a propensity towards art or music. You know, I have a lot of clients that are like incredible musicians or incredible writers or incredible actors or incredible, you know, artists in some way. And it's not just that they have been, you know, quote, gifted a particular ability. They may have a sort of proclivity towards music, art, you know, whatever, but they've also refined that. They've practiced, they've increased their skill set, they've intentionally used their brain and their brain plasticity to refine and become really good at that thing that they have a proclivity towards. And for me, that's intuition. And so, I mean, I hold quite a apparently controversial view on intuition, which is that I think that most of the time, a refined intuition is actually a trauma response. So that is to say, it started as a survival mechanism, and I can certainly only speak for myself. I believe this totally to be true for me, that I came into this world with a natural connection, greater, stronger connection to, let's say, that the universe than maybe others. But it was the need to survive that pushed me to refine that and develop an intuition so that I could stay safe. And I think that for a lot of people that work as professional intuitives and psychics, and I've certainly found this to be the case in terms of, you know, all the people that I know and people that come to me for readings who are also psychics, this is the case, that there is some kind of need that developed the intuitive faculty to survive. And so psychic work for me is, I think, my ability to access and use that intuitive faculty to gather extra information. And then the other part of it, of being an effective and good psychic, is your capacity to communicate that in a way that the person that needs it can understand.
It's really helpful for me because I also have, you know, thinking about what we mean by psychic as being a highly developed intuitive sense is really, really helpful for translating it for someone like me. A lot of the time when I'm coming to interview someone, I have a set of associations about their world that I know are faulty, which is why I want to talk to them and understand better. But probably for the rest of some of the audience as well, certainly my kind of base level as someone who really knows nothing about this world, associations with psychic is kind of like regional town theater, come and fill the rows and people go. And my immediate story that I tell about it is that many of the people in that world are a bit exploitative because people are coming to them with desperation. I hope this is not offensive. I'm aware this is my, like, this was my,
Okay, good. This was my like working model. Could you say a little bit about the wider industry or field, where you think wisdom is, where there are risks and threats to it, for in terms of if we're all trying to grow up our souls and in wisdom, where it helps and where it doesn't?
Yeah, I mean, I've got so much to say about this. So one thing is, I think that this image that you've drawn is really accurate. I think that is how a lot of people view and the associations that they have with the word psychic, and why I have so much hesitation, you know, about using it. But also, I think that there's something very powerful in reclaiming it for a collection of reasons. So the first is, I think what you're describing is actually probably more connected to mediumship. So there's a distinction between psychic and psychic medium. And mediumship is in specifically connecting or using this intuitive ability, or let's say this privileged connection to a source of knowledge and wisdom that is not logical. Let's just have that as our working model for psychic. There is a psychic medium uses that privileged connection to connect to dead people, right? People who have the term is like passed over, the concept being that there is a second life, another life, where it's possible for us to communicate with the dead. I have always had huge resistance and big difficulties with that, and avoided mediumship at like great expense to me in lots of ways. And yet I have also had multiple experiences of dead people communicating to me, or at least what on the surface I would be able to as close as possible explain to you, like, that's what it seemed like, you know, very specific detailed information about people I didn't know who were dead, bombarding me often at night, often when I'm asleep or when I'm on my own, to deliver a message to a specific person. And most of the time, a person I do not know and have nothing to do with. So as somebody who, you know, ethically, you know, to some extent culturally, was very against this whole concept, I can say hand on heart, I thought it was all exploitative, like Victorian style penny arcade bullshit. And yet it's also been my very lived experience that despite holding those views and actively rejecting and refusing and telling myself, this is insane, this isn't happening, I can't do it, it's happened. The other thing that I think is important to note is we see this shift in the 19th century towards a real fascination with the development of spiritualism. So in the history of psychic work, healing work, and intuition, we have a real pushback against the Industrial Revolution and the scientific explosion. And that inevitably, in all cultures across the board, there is always a sort of swing of the pendulum. And what we see in Victorian England is this swing towards, against rather, the sort of scientific method and materialism and imperialism, empiricalism. And also what emerges from that is this idea of the psychic medium holding court in churches. Of course, we get the spiritualist church emerge where that's literally what happens. And so an important piece about this is so much, I believe, of our prejudice against, and I say this as somebody who held this prejudice and to some extent still does because it's deeply ingrained, is also a form of classism, because what we see in the development of spiritualism and particularly mediums and the growth of psychic mediums is the development of a group, a class of people who had no structural power, who had no access to education. These are often people who were literally like pushed into factory work. There was no general education. There was no philosophical training. There was no way for them to educate or learn or gain access to power structurally. And there is an emergence we see of these same people gaining access. And it's the same sort of phenomena that we see with mystics vis-a-vis the church and any, their relationship with the structures of power that like to contain relationship to God, relationship to the divine, relationship to privileged information. And I think that a huge amount of the denigration, rejection, ridicule, and ultimately kind of negative connotations that are connected to spiritualism and psychic acts is ultimately a form of invalidating, a form of knowledge that people who had no access to structures of power had. So I think there's that. Now, the other thing I have to say about this is, you know, with psychic work, the point about it is that it is non-rational, right? This is not a form of knowing I don't tell my clients the things I tell them because I know that if you invest X amount of money in this stock, it's going to result in that outcome because I know anything about the stock or because I know anything about anything. I'm not accessing this information using the rational, you know, faculty. I'm accessing this information using a totally different faculty, which is not considered valid under contemporary culture. And the whole history of what is considered a valid way of knowing and a valid form of knowledge is fascinating and very, very, very interconnected with oppression. It's interconnected with classism and deeply connected to misogyny. So in essence, what I would say is I think the negative connotations around psychics and specifically psychic mediumship is bound up with keeping people in their place. And specifically the way in which post-Enlightenment intellectual culture has dominated is by saying there are only certain forms of knowing that are valid and there are only certain knowers that are valid. And those forms of knowing that are valid are rationality, empirical information, the scientific method. If you actually investigate the scientific method, it is entirely intuitive, but that's another conversation. There'll be some great people that talk about that, that you might really love and know of, I'm sure. And that the knowers that are valid are going to be white men. And so if you don't fall in any of those categories, and particularly if you are not a man and you are not using a form of knowledge that is considered valuable, you will be denigrated, you will be ridiculed, and you will be suppressed. So, you know, I think that the sort of negative connotations around psychic work are intricately connected to socio-economic oppression and ultimately the Enlightenment and colonialism.
I think there's an interesting parallel here. I'm finding all this very thought-provoking and quite challenging because one of the things I write about in my book is my charismatic form of Christian expression has played a similar role in the history of the church, right? It has both inside and outside the church, expressions of enthusiasm. You know, that's what enthusiasm used to mean, these like emotional embodied forms of religious practice and entheos, filled with God, were embarrassing, right? Embarrassing and outside the mainstream and not in the center. And it is traditionally this kind of Pentecostal charismatic expressions of faith are most common amongst the poor and still brown people and women. And so my part of my conversion story around that and then attempting to be an atheist for a while and then coming back to what felt like a more kind of austere, rational form of Christian practice and then right back round to like, no, I want to pray in tongues and lie on the floor and have a cry. And I am no longer ashamed of that, partly through the work of Ian McGilchrist and my understanding of like different epistemologies, different forms of knowing. But I want to just pick up one thread for the listener because you've talked about stocks and what they won't necessarily yet know is that you move from this quite hand-to-mouth existence, having left home really young, you know, charging by the hour as a psychic, to this very successful business as an industrial intuitive advising, you know, Fortune 500 companies. Could you just, I know it's a lot, there's a memoir in there, but could you just like do the dots between how did you move from that to this completely different world of using your skills?
Yeah, so I went through a period of time really where I was, as you say, hand to mouth and working entirely just with individuals. So I moved to Glastonbury in Somerset, which is the sort of epicenter for spiritual pilgrimage of all traditions, actually, fascinatingly, but certainly the sort of center of the home of the New Age, we could say, and was very, very drawn there, couldn't really explain it or understand it, felt very conflicted about it because I didn't fit in at all, and I still do not fit in Glastonbury. I'm kind of infamous, I think, as not the Glastonbury person. But I was there for 7 years and very successfully, but was still, you know, doing this sort of one-to-one readings with individuals. And ultimately, what happened was I was very good at what I did. And so word of mouth spread, and I started seeing all sorts of people. So people would come in from all over the world to have a session with me. And this is when I, you know, I was really like 20 years old, 90, I was young. And one of those people, or a collection of those people, actually, it's not really just down to one, would be people that would that had businesses, and often would be in very senior positions with very big businesses. And of course there, and I say of course, because I was so naive, I was 20, maybe 21 years old, I wasn't, you know, a child and also a bit of an idiot. And I was charging like £25 for an hour of my time, and I would be giving them just, you know, so much value. And they saw that. And so basically what happened is that they sort of plucked me out of that and were like, okay, how can we use this? How can we use this? They didn't care. This is the thing that I think I would like everybody to understand about industrial intuition, is that most of the concern and the anxiety about the epistemological validity of psychic work is really held by the middle classes, right? It really is. It's like those of us who have a sort of enough understanding of, you know, knowledge and philosophy and natural science to kind of have questions, but not enough of an education or an understanding to actually deeply question why we think we know what we think we know. And most of the people that are making the most money in the world, and I say this with absolute confidence because I know them, they are using any form of extra information that they can. They don't care where and how I get the information. They're not even interested in why or how I know these things. They care about the bottom line. And so when I realized this and discovered this, I've never been somebody that has been trying to prove my value, like not ever, and I never will be. I went through a period of time where I felt very concerned, I suppose, and I still have this, am I giving enough? That's a different kind of question. But in terms of like, was it valuable? Like that I wasn't trying to ever prove to somebody that psychic, I'm problematizing this word, but you know, intuitive information was valuable because it just evidently was. And so I had these clients that then, you know, wanted to work with me to find out how they could use me as a resource. And so for a period of time, and by the way, I basically don't do this anymore for a collection of political reasons. And also I don't need to. But I would work with large corporations and with their board of directors. So I would have one member on the C-suite. So that's the, you know, top level of management. I would need to work with somebody who had directorial control, i.e. they had the capacity to make decisions and choices. And I would sit with them. They would be my handler. And then I would do my work. That is to say, I would close my eyes and access the cloud, bring it down into the knife, and give them data. That's how it really ultimately would be. And then they would use that data, and then they would make more money. And so, yes, I did that for over a decade. And I think, you know, I definitely didn't charge enough money. That's one thing I would say, is that I know that I'm responsible for making millions of pounds for people. You know, a part of the reason that I don't do this anymore, I mean, occasionally if there is a circumstance or a situation or a client that I feel like is absolutely aligned politically with me, that I feel is really good and excited about, then absolutely I will. But it's very boring work. It's not very satisfying. It doesn't feel meaningful to me. It ultimately is just stoking the fires of, you know, capitalist industry. I did it because I needed to. But I mean, it's so dull. and I'm intelligent and creative, and I didn't want to do that with my life. And I wasn't even being charged, you know, wasn't even being paid sufficiently. I think at the time I was being paid like, I don't know, £5,000 a day or something silly like that, you know.
skating over the silliness or otherwise of that figure. this is blowing my mind a little bit, because presumably within that company, that your handler would come back and say, right, Kate says these three things. Presumably internally there was a bit of like, well, what if we put £100,000 in marketing towards this pair of shoes and she's wrong?
Yeah,
like,
of course.
My experience of working with businesses is people, at least even if it's frankly made up, they want an argument for the why. How does that work?
So my attitude was very much like, that's not my problem.
Right. So they've got to that point before calling you in anyway.
Exactly. So right. I think in my experience, what would happen is, well, I think there's two things. With small businesses, I think that's definitely what you're describing is very much true, which is that there is this kind of terror of, you know, but also you just start small. So that's, you know, £100,000 to a multinational, true multinational global business is really nothing. That's like the salary of an intern that they don't even know exists. Like, really, we're looking at scales here of income that are mind-blowing and depressing. But they wouldn't start with investing £100,000. They would start really, really small, and then it would just be evidential. So it's just simply, it would be like, you know, ultimately result price, you know, payment on results. I would only get rehired if it ended up being correct and accurate. And nobody's correct 100% of the time, but if you're hitting 80 to 85% accuracy rates, then that is fucking amazing in business. If you're hitting 52% accuracy rates, they're going to hire you, and they're going to hire you again. But I think that one of the things that I did quite well, I think even when I say, you know, something ridiculous like £5,000 a day, yes, £5,000 a day is a very, very good day rate, but not if a company has a turnover of 10 billion.
Not as a proportion of their budget.
Right. And if my piece of information, that full day of 8 hours of very, very, very labor intensive, even if boring work, resulted in them making an extra £1 million, then yeah, £5,000 is a ridiculous amount for me to be charging. So, which is partly why I don't really, it's not very, I'm concerned, you know, this is the thing, I suppose, going back to this, what do I consider sacred? And the whole point, I suppose, of our conversation is, you know, like, money is not sacred. Validation is not sacred. Fame is absolutely the opposite of sacrality. And all of those things, you know, like, I have had, but that's not what gives me meaning or joy. And what do I want to do with my life? I want to make art, and I want to make happiness, and I want to spend time with people I love, and I want to eat and cook good food, and I want to listen to music, and I want to, you know, be in the sun, and I want to dance, and I want to choose what I wear in this form of play. And oh, it's the opposite of that. That is like the opposite of all of that. So, you know, I think, it was ultimately quite boring work that was necessary. And I'm glad that I did it. It kind of got me out of various different financial holes at different times. And I met wonderful people who I'm still good friends with. The first person that hired me at a big global brand, you know, still we email regularly and have lunch when we're in the same city. But, you know, it's not something that I think is meaningful, you know.
Yeah.
God knows it's not sacred.
Yes, I realize my reaction to that figure is much more about my formation in the not-for-profit sector and my naivety about that world, really, which is why it's helpful to hear about it. I want to talk to you specifically about astrology and tarot, and I may be being just very naive to even attempt to talk about them both at the same time, but it feels like, as I've been, you know, around a religion think tank, I did religion programming for the BBC, and the spiritual landscape has changed so rapidly in the last 15 years. And it's not that people weren't, you know, using tarot cards or interested in astrology before then, but the mainstreaming, particularly amongst younger women, of these traditions as sources of insight and knowledge and wisdom has gone through the roof. And for those of us who don't know much about it, I think can just sort of look on a bit baffled. Could you say a little bit about your journey? Like, what drew you to these? You talk about them as languages that you speak. You know, what are you seeing in them, and why are they part of your practice?
So I had a very negative connotation with both astrology and tarot up until really the age of 16 because of my upbringing. And I was scared. I was scared of tarot. One of the ways in which, you know, forms of oppression work, of course, is to disenfranchise us from our natural intuition and our natural source of access. But it's also to demonize, literally to associate with the devil, those tools or you know, practices that are associated with people who are not considered valid knowers, that are disenfranchised in so many ways already. And I think the tarot and astrology sort of suffer heavily from that. I first encountered tarot directly when I was 16, and I had a kind of formative experience where I had a dream. I would always very vivid dreams. I had a dream. I was in Glastonbury at the time. It was the first time that I'd ever visited the town, and I didn't really know anything about it. And I dreamt, and in this dream, I walked out of the bed and breakfast that I was staying in, walked down the road, turned down another alley, and went up some stairs, and had a tarot reading. And this was a dream of mine. And I woke up with this knowledge that this is real. You have to go and do that. And it's very difficult to communicate, you know, it's the ineffable mystical experience again. You know, like, I just knew I had to do this. There wasn't really a question about it. I don't really feel like it was a voluntary thing. So I did. I got dressed, walked downstairs, walked down the road, found the thing, found the place. And it was like this very, you know, like hidden away. It wasn't on the high street. It wasn't an obvious place. You know, I didn't know, hadn't been there before. Walked up the stairs, and this woman was there, and she says, "Oh, I've been expecting you. I put the heater on." And I was like, "What do you mean you've been expecting me?" Like, whatever. And I'm at 16, you know, I was like obnoxious, I think, as most 16-year-olds are, but certainly coming from this sort of atheist materialist background where I was like, "Oh, this is all bullshit," you know, like this exploitative, you know, I really held that. I really absolutely, it's like a comportment towards this anything that's not validated of mistrust, you know, like, and it's, I still find this just truly depressing. And one of the ways that, you know, people are very traumatized and that trauma shows up is just like, if the primary lens that one sees the world through is a fear of being exploited and a lens of mistrust, then my God, your life is so stunted. It's so disabling. Anyway, I had that. And so I was like eye rolling a little bit, but also found myself there, was compelled. And there was a part of me that was freaked out because, you know, oh my God, what just happened? I had this dream. I didn't see the woman in the dream. I just had the dream of the journey to her. Anyway, I walked in, she opens the door. She hadn't indeed turned the heater on. And she's like, "Sit down." And I go and I sit down in a chair. And she's like, "That's not your chair. That's my chair." And I was like, "Oh, okay, sorry, sit in the other chair." She's like, "Oh, but you are meant to be a reader. You are meant to be a tarot reader." And I was like, okay, you know, eye roll, like whatever. But also part of me was like, am I? Because like, I don't know what I am, but it's not normal. You know, give me something, anything you can tell me, please. And then she proceeded to give me a tarot reading. And it was really amazing and also sort of very sad in many ways because, it, you know, I was 16 then. I was in this abusive relationship and would be in that abusive relationship until that man died. You know, there's a lot written misinformation about my apparently four husbands. I've never been married four times, but my first partner, long-term partner, died of cancer when I was 22, and it was horrific. And I was with him until he was 22, until I was 22. And she basically, she didn't tell me this, but she's, you know, described an awful amount of accuracy about who I was and what I would go on to experience and the primary struggles of my life, all of which, alas, have turned out to be absolutely accurate. But the tarot was the thing that I left with. Oh my God, this is something. And the images on the cards that she used, in fact, I have the same cards right now here with me. You know, like these are the deck, because I immediately went out and went to a shop and bought the same deck of cards. And then I taught myself how to read the tarot. So I love the tarot. I as you said, you know, I describe it as a language that I speak. I speak it fluently. I feel very passionate about it, and you know, could talk endlessly about it. But it, in essence, I think a helpful way to think of the tarot is it's a symbolic book that is unbound. Okay, so you have 72 pages to this book, and each page contains a whole collection of symbolism that offers access to true knowledge and also describes archetypal experiences. So the tarot is made up of two decks, actually, the major and the minor arcana. And these are often shuffled together and mixed up. The major arcana, there are 21 cards, and each one of those cards is describing an archetypal experience. So, you know, the idea of archetypes obviously is Jung, from Jung, and the tarot predates Jung by many hundreds of years. Nobody really knows where the tarot emerged from, but we think sort of 13th century, something like that, Central Europe, maybe Italy, maybe Marseille, depending on who you read. There's no any way of knowing. Some people claim it's ancient Egyptian, but I think that's less evidence for that, and that's more a sort of orientalist colonial view on, you know, the mystic East. But ultimately, the tarot in its pages, and if you think about it as a book that is, you know, unbound, then as you shuffle, you are connecting, or one is connecting. This is my view on this. Everybody has a different view, although I think this is sort of most cohesive and useful way of understanding, is that as you're shuffling, as the person engaging with the cards and being in communication and in relationship with this being that is the tarot deck, I understand as a being, you're asking, you're holding an intention to have wisdom revealed to you about your present moment. What is happening right now that I need to know about? And so as you shuffle these different pages that tell different stories, that illustrate certain experiences, get ordered in a particular way. And then when you turn the cards over, and the classic spread is called the Celtic cross. It's a 10-card spread generally. And each position of each card correlates with a particular meaning. So the first card will be you, the querent. What is the card that represents you? The second card will be the crossing card. What is the primary challenge that you in this moment are dealing with? And then the card above it would be, what is the energy, the environment that you're in? The fourth card beneath it, what are the unconscious drives? And so on. So that each card, as you lay the cards down on a particular position with a particular intention, is revealing more information that some of which you will know and recognize. A good, you know, every tarot reading will be wildly accurate in certain ways, even if you're doing what I call a flat reading, which is just simply reading the cards without the extra intuition. But you will get your life reflected back to you in that present moment. And so it's such a powerful tool for cultivation of relationship to the self, deeper self-knowledge. And then, you know, coming back to that fundamental belief I hold, which is that it's only through deep relationship to the self that we have the capacity to understand anything else. So I think it's an incredibly powerful, very meaningful tool. And it doesn't have to be associated or connected with any spiritual being. So, for example, it's not that, you know, you have to come from a particular religion or you have to hold a particular cosmology. You know, Jung writes an awful lot about the tarot, which might be very accessible for people that are sort of cautious or anxious about it from religious perspectives. It's like, you know, when you hold a glass onto some choppy water, it's like you can see what's going on underneath. That is how I view the tarot. It's a tool that allows a deepening of understanding of what is happening for you in that moment. And then depending on how skilled and refined your interpretations are of the symbolism, you can get extremely detailed, incredibly accurate imagery, clarity, wisdom from it.
Yeah. I think when I've listened to my friends who find it useful, you used this great phrase earlier, which I also really like about meaning making. You know, humans are meaning making creatures. Charles Taylor says we are storied selves, right? We are constantly trying to locate ourselves in a story. Like, where am I? Am I in crisis? Am I in calm? Am I on a hero's journey? You know, do I need to just tough through this valley of the shadow of death to come into the sunlit uplands? Or we can't help it. You know, it's one of the reasons I think that one of the things I find my faith gives me is this ability to locate myself in a bigger story that I play a part in, but is not just about me, right? It's this larger narrative. As someone who, well, you know, became a Christian, then was not, and now am again, I you know, have a complex relationship. I think everyone should know the tensions in their own tradition, right? And I certainly know the tensions in mine. But for kind of
Christian listeners and others just interested in the spiritual landscape, what do you think is happening whereby, you know, two or three generations ago, that meaning making would have happened in religious traditions, right? Would have happened in congregations. People would have gone to church to try and locate themselves in a bigger story and understand themselves. And now they're not. And they are increasingly drawing on these esoteric forms of knowledge. What's your diagnosis for why that's happening?
I think that as we become more connected in other ways, and most notably, obviously, the internet being a big piece of it, but also, you know, general global travel as the world becomes smaller, as the sort of mycelium of technology and the network increases, I think that where previously religious communities, church specifically Christian communities, had the sort of monopoly on spiritual experience and particularly access to the mycelium of connection, spirituality, deeper meaning. That's not the case anymore. I think it's really as simple as that, is that, you know, we see that, you know, when we're looking back, part of my PhD was looking at the ways in which, or a large part of the PhD was looking at ways in which women mystics, all the way from the 10th century up until contemporary times, are treated by the church, the Catholic Church, but also their religious communities generally. And what we see is that in the 10th century, you know, people who are now considered doctors of the church, or are doctors of the church, and were also burnt at the stake by the same church, by the way, classic, talk about tension within the tradition, would have, you know, been doing what I'm doing, I think. So that is to say, I don't think it's anything specifically to do with Christianity. I don't think it's anything to do specifically with religion as such, rather that it is to do with structured, hierarchical, dogmatic forms of connection to the divine, literally just not holding up anymore. Like, they can't.
There's so much I'd like to talk to you about, but I want to honor your time. So I'm going to end with a question about these new forms of spiritual leadership of which you represent a part. And you seem like someone who could tolerate a lot of frankness, which is part of the reason I wanted to talk to you. So I, you give me so many thoughts. So the sort of fundamental question is about how do you carry the responsibility of people leaving behind these traditional forms of religious leadership, which, as we know, have fragilities and fail us, but also have kind of systems and processes that, by and large, at different times and spaces, can be protective against those, you know, forms of accountability and oversight and seminary, you know, and training, and this sense in which being a spiritual leader is a high calling, and you need to take it seriously, and you need to get trained, and then you need to remain in structures that will help you carry that power well. When people are moving out of those religious traditions into this more, I wanted to say it feels like the Wild West, and the Wild West had lots of good stuff about it as well, right? But when I came to first think about writing my book, which is kind of trying to translate the Christian tradition to those who don't know much about it, I said to a friend of mine, if I become an Instagram spiritual influencer, will you shoot me in the head? Which is one of my judgier moments, right? Which I repent of. But it's because, and the reason I feel safe talking to you about this is because I have also heard you query some of the ethics of this world. How do you carry the responsibility of people looking to you for wisdom in an age where you don't get priested? You have to do these kind of apprenticeships in the kind of knowledge that you've had.
That's a great question. And I care very much about this. I think I've got two things to say, I suppose. The first is, oh my goodness, having been involved in seminarian training and being very deeply involved in for many years, not just through academic theology, but personally, not myself, but socially, being connected to many priests and many priests in training, and actually, in fact, you know, being involved in the training of priests for a very short period of time, like literally, like one day, but nonetheless, I can say it's a very bad system. Nothing that, you know, it's not just that it's a very bad system, it is a fundamentally flawed system. And so although there is this ideal of going through a process of, you know, discernment and discernment of vocation and clarifying, you know, the fundamental problem, I believe, and I can only speak about the Church of England and the Catholic Church, because those are my areas of expertise and experience. The fundamental problem with the training of priests in both of those Christian traditions is that it is ultimately still governed and dominated by the structures of oppression that cause all the problems in the world. And that is to say patriarchy, capitalism, and specifically colonialism. And so I have to say, I just do not hold any respect, zero, for such training. So that's the first thing. And I think that the danger of it is that it has got this facade. It's got this facade of like structure and organizing and integrity. And there is not integrity in it. And I, you know, this isn't going to be particularly controversial because long ago I have been exiled from these communities and, you know, banned from Catholic conferences. And, you know, it's kind of funny to me, but I have to say, it's not to say that there aren't good people doing good work with true integrity in there. There absolutely is. Absolutely there are. I know them. These are friends of mine. However, the structures are concerned with maintaining power. And I say that with complete confidence. Part of the work that I did academically was on exposing this and exploring this. The training of priests is really the maintenance of power and the maintenance of hierarchy. The second part of this is to say, I think the solution, if you like, or the way in which I prioritize avoiding being, I don't want to replicate that. I think that's the thing, is that I do not have any interest in replicating structures of oppression and hierarchical, organizations and anything like that. And so the way that we do that is we redistribute power, and we constantly need to be empowering the individual, other people, and through community. So my concern entirely is not with, you know, my goodness, and it's very difficult, and I struggle with it. The amount of responsibility that people want to give to me is overwhelming, and it is a cause of incredible suffering, has been a cause of incredible suffering for me, because I just, like I've said, just want to hang out and like paint pictures and cook food and spend time with people that I love and make music and art and be in the sun. And yet I also know that I have a very heavy responsibility when I'm in a particular position of getting access to information and then giving it to people. So the solution, I believe, fundamentally will always be community, access to community and redistribution of power. So any power that I have, you know, like doing this podcast, why am I doing this podcast and not somebody else? Well, for a whole collection of reasons, right, that are deeply connected to my privilege, my access, my visibility, my whiteness, my education.
My tribalism.
Right. But that's, we can't, it's not that that these are bad things necessarily. Some of those are bad things, you know, like, but most of, it's not that it's bad. It's that we have a responsibility when we have access, or we have a platform, or we have power. And we'll talk about the platform because that's the question. To use that platform to redistribute power as much as possible. So for example, the work that I do now, you know, having gone through this whole process of not wanting to, you know, my God, I didn't want to be a psychic. I didn't want to do any of this crazy work. This is not the life that I chose for myself at all when I was, you know, really, I chose this life, I think maybe at the age of 35, you know, so that's like 5 years, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and I hold it. But you know, this life that I've got now is like, okay, this is how we make the best of it. This is how we make the best of it, my friend. but I think the point about the platform is we need to focus on community, and we need to focus on redistribution. I don't want to hold power. I don't. But the power that is given to me because of my proximity to structures of, you know, there's two different types of power. There's structural power and there's, you know, authentic power. And I have a lot of structural power because of my proximity to oppressive structures of power. I'm white, I'm cisgendered, you know, I'm highly educated. I have a lot of connections to conventional forms of beauty, despite what a lot of people on Reddit say. I know that these are my, and I can laugh about it because I know this, right? Like, I know that these are my strengths and my association and connection to those quite oppressive forms of power. That power is stolen from people who don't occupy that. Mm. That don't occupy that proximity. And so my responsibility is to use that power that is given to me, whether I want it or not. I've got to use it in service of redistributing that power to those people from whom have been disenfranchised, from whom it's been stolen. All of my concern and my work is focused on creating space, holding space for true, authentic community to happen, where other people that are not in the position that I'm in can be empowered, get a strength and a sense of relationship to themselves, so then they can do what I'm doing, and it goes on.
Dr. Kate Thomas, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Sacred.
Oh, it was such a pleasure, and I enjoyed every moment. Thank you.
Well, gosh, I learned a lot in that conversation. I did not know the difference between a medium and a psychic. Industrial intuitives, mind blown. Feel like I have an understanding of tarot as a meaning-making process for people. I think, if I'm being really honest, the thing I need to surface in these reflections is my reaction to the word witch, I have been surprised to find in myself. I wanted to interview Kate because I went looking for someone to help me understand the shifting spiritual landscape and the way people are being drawn to these non-religious spiritual practices. And I realize it's probably offensive to kind of lump them all together. But to help me understand at least part of that world. And I knew that she was involved in tarot and in psychic work and astrology and things like that. And I also knew that she, other people had used the language about, used witch as language about her, and she'd sometimes use it and sometimes hadn't. But it was only when we were into the interview that I found myself reacting to that word quite strongly. And I think what it surfaced for me is how deep the antipathy has gone historically between Christians and those who would call themselves witches, or certainly how deep and still present is hostility amongst many Christians to this concept of witchcraft, partly because of some of the things that says in scripture, partly because of tradition, whether or not the signifier as used and understood by Christians is the same thing as the way Kate is using it or other people involved in it are using it. I don't know. We didn't get deep into her practice because I was really just trying to understand her as a person. But I sort of do need to name that. For me, I've spoken to so many people who I have very different worldviews from, different political beliefs, different metaphysical beliefs. And I didn't necessarily expect to feel honestly, not towards Kate, but the hostility to that word and concept that I discovered in myself. This is something that goes back centuries, right? These are two groups of people who feel very hurt or misunderstood or attacked by the other often. And I just needed to name it. And that reaction that I had and, you know, I'm holding and working through will be different for you, possibly. Maybe you have the same thing. But part of the point of this project is to notice those things in ourselves and to react consciously and intentionally, not in this knee-jerk hostility. And what I need to remind myself in moments like this, and I'm getting better at it, is difference, even deep disagreement, bordering on suspicion of someone's beliefs and practices at points, potentially, doesn't mean that you can't have a curious, open, respectful, empathetic conversation. And in fact, that you can't really like and respect each other and maybe even end up friends. That this sense that difference is a threat is a belief, not a fact about the world. That difference can be a gift and it can be something that we can navigate with openness and curiosity, but we only get good at that when we become conscious of our deep-seated tribalisms. And the other thing that that made me think about is I think I pretty unconsciously wanted to speak to Kate
because of all the people who have the label witch associated with them, she's the one that felt safest. And she felt safe because of this people like me syndrome that I talk about a lot, and particularly in the Roth chapter in Fully Alive. Scientists call it homophily. John Yates helpfully codified it as people like me syndrome. We all prefer people like ourselves. And Kate is a theology nerd, right? She's got a PhD from Oxford in female mystics. She's a theology nerd. So am I. You know, we're both in our 40s and we're tall and brunette. It's ridiculously granular, these ways in which we're drawn to people that remind us of ourselves. And so halfway through the interview, I was like, oh, I felt safe talking to you because you remind me of myself. And that's a really embarrassing thing to admit. But I think it's more universal than we realize that. And I think that's something that I've done before. You know, I wanted to understand the experience of a trans woman. So I spoke to Rachel Mann because she likes poetry and she's a vicar. And I feel very able to connect around those things. I wanted to speak to someone who is very politically and socially conservative. And so I spoke to Peter Hitchens because we're both Christians and we've got a point of connection. And again, on a range of different things. But I wonder if I want to leave you then with the question, what are these categories or identities that function for you in that way that which did, maybe still does for me as a trigger word? And who in those categories or identities could you listen to? Could you just seek to understand? Could you approach with respect, curiosity, empathy? And a way to make that easier is to find someone who in some way reminds you of yourself or reminds you of someone that you love. It might mean that I am not an anti-tribalism ninja because I'm still having to use these guardrails, these handrails, but that's okay. We go at our own pace. We learn as we go. I'd love to hear what you thought. I really value your input, what this episode was making you reflect on in your own life, your own beliefs, your own values. You can get in touch with me via social media, via my Substack, or we have an email associated with the podcast. Till next time, thank you so much for listening to The Sacred, which is a project of the think tank Theos, and we'd love you to go check out Theos's wider work. Our production team are Lizzie Harvey, Dan Turner, and Amari Ugandran. Until next time. Oh.